method of crime prevention. I should begin by acknowledging the act of academic fraud I'm about to perpetrate by passing another's words off as my own. The person that I've relied on for guidance, one of the people in the Office of Science and Technology, Richard Davis, has been enormously helpful. And furthermore, I unfortunately can't stay for dinner, and so Richard will be here for the subsequent discussion. And such questions as may arise from the presentation I give or the workings of the panel in relation to the Office of Science and Technology, Richard will be able to answer much more authoritatively than I can. I nonetheless embraced the chance to give the talk here tonight, and not simply because I enjoy giving talks here, but because it was an opportunity to learn more about one of the most interesting of the task forces engaged in foresight. I'm going to say a couple of words by way of introduction about foresight, even though it's probably not necessary. The original foresight exercise, which is coterminous with the beginning of the creation of the Office of Science and Technology, had 16 panels right across the waterfront, not just things that you think of as technology like chemicals and energy, but food and drink and leisure and learning. But we quickly realised that there were many themes that cut right across all the different panels. So as we have relaunched the exercise for the millennium, we have fewer panels, 10 panels, roughly half the number, each with a broader remit, and we very deliberately have three other panels that cut across on thematic topics that cut across all the panels, one of which is ageing, just partly because all the foresight people got a bit older perhaps, and another of which is crime and fraud, and another one of which is recognising that manufacturing is involved in all the different things. And it was a category error to think it was something like chemicals, because it again is pervasive. And two underpinning themes, education and training and sustainable development. And I think this particular report from the panel that we're talking about this evening is particularly interesting. The last thing I would say about foresight, just picking up on one of the things that was said earlier, to my mind, the process of foresight is far more important than the individual products. That is to say, it is meant to try and help us in this country do a better job of connecting academia with the marketplace. And doing that by bringing people from business and industry and government and academia and research institutes together to talk from their different perspectives about shared interests, to help create better networks so we have more awareness from the science-based side of the opportunities out there in the marketplace, and more awareness in the marketplace of the opportunities both for new ideas and for problem solving in academia. And we do that round the rubric of thinking what's coming down the road, but recognising that what's coming down the road will always hold surprises anyhow. So I think this exercise differs from the conventional foresight exercise in most countries in that sense of the animating spirit is the process rather than the product. Turning specifically then to what we're talking about tonight, and taking my brief, which was to focus a little bit more particularly on what are some of the new technologies and how they're going to play out against this general question of technology and crime, as it were. I think one of the interesting perceptions that has also come generally out of many of the foresight panels and task forces, but comes particularly out of this one, is that the essential piece of science that bears on most of the questions is more commonly than not social science rather than one of the so-called harder, that is to say easier sciences, physical or life sciences, which it's the social sciences that are often the limiting factor. And I think we'll hear in some sense more of that in the next talk, if I guess correctly, because although I'm going to go on in a moment to talk about the various technologies and some of their implications, whether or not and how wisely we will use them is going to depend on the interplay between the technology itself and the concerns that people will have, some people more than others, about how intrusive these technologies could be as defences against criminality. You know, how acceptable they are, what's their potential for abuse, for misuse. And ultimately, the question that any really civilised society has to ask itself, which is how large are societal cost are you willing to bear? What imposition of measures are you, what intrusions into privacy are you willing to put up with in order to prevent crime? And that's an interesting thing on which different people have different views. And very interestingly, the professionals who tend to discuss it are quite often not representative of what society in general would think about it. I mean, we all are aware probably if you took a general vote, probably you would get, certainly in America, if you took a general vote, you'd get a clear yes vote for retaining the capital punishment. And I think you'd probably get that in the UK too, even though when you move into the circles that discuss that, I think very properly, you act to values which are not necessarily a simple reflection of democracy. And I think that underlies a lot of the discussion here in ways that we don't conventionally discuss. Well, that's enough of that. Back to things I'm more comfortable talking about. What are some of the opportunities, both for new methods of doing naughty things and new ways of combating it that are going to come out of science? And I discuss it briefly under three headings. The things that come out of biotechnology, advances in understanding the human genome are going to already provide us with an extraordinary armamentarium of identifying individuals in an almost entirely unambiguous way by minuscule shadows they leave behind them. And we're going to get even cleverer. The things we can do today, which virtually defy imagination and certainly defy the ability of most American courts to handle them, are but a fleeting shadow in front of what's to come. We have a rapidly growing database of DNA that has been taken from people convicted of charges, buccal cells from inside the mouth being one of the most convenient things. You can take these things, you have the same right of arrest to take them as you do when you take fingerprints. You can only keep them if you get a conviction. That's a growing database. It's growing at a rate, it's quite large, rather alarmingly large in some ways, given the criterion for keeping it. And it's more than just a database that will enable you finding a minute trace of somebody, a bit of a fingerprint, trace of semen, to whack it into a machine, and the machines will get more sophisticated, and they're already very sophisticated, whack it into a machine that will not merely print out some identification of bits of the DNA, but can match it up against a database as large as you want and do it in faster than it takes me to say it virtually. Way ahead of the court's ability to handle this in the face of the confusion created, not just by lawyers, but some of my lefty colleagues who find this more fun than they've ever had anywhere else, in disputing and questioning what is the single best kind of evidence that you're going to get in the imperfections and confusions of legal cases. And there are many more things we can do with that. You can already take that database, you can take a bit of DNA, and increasingly we'll be able to say things that are very politically incorrect. We'll be able to make statistical guesses as to things like the height or the hair colour or the eye colour or the skin colour or other characteristics of the person who left the trace. And they're just plain facts. They'll be statistical facts. They'll have uncertainties like everything else does. Nothing like the uncertainties of eyewitness accounts who positively identify people in lineups, but uncertainties nonetheless. But that won't be the battleground that's fought out by people of good intentions who will feel some of these things are just politically incorrect things to be doing. Again, coming back to the social sciences, whether we're talking about genetic signatures that are unique to individuals or eye patterns or various biometric characteristics which will be increasingly able to identify each one of us far more uniquely than the crudity of fingerprints, or whether we're talking about just issuing smart cards that encode that kind of information so that they're less stealable but put all sorts of stuff else on them for different reasons to combat other kinds of fraud on the social security front, in social services front. How we introduce these things is not going to have much to do with the underlying science that created it. It's going to have wholly to do with the social science of how we handle them. If somebody had come along most of us forget that there was a world not all that long ago when people by and large used money rather than credit cards. If you go to a place like Japan, to find a technologically advanced society that still hardly uses credit cards once you move outside the little Western enclaves and the hotels that cater to them, it's startling. But I wonder if we'd have them now if banks had said to me, you must have a credit card and we won't take checks anymore. They were introduced in a sense, in the best sense of the word, just by, as it were, stealth, by letting them creep out and letting their use be defined by their usefulness. And in some sense that I don't clearly understand, I think a large part of our path toward making wise use of these techniques, both to protect people and property and to identify those who violate the canons of a civilized society, is going to depend on how we introduce them in a non-draconian, gradual way. How identity cards that are smarter and more protective are done by option, not by demand. It's got to be something that I choose to do and that gradually just becomes so pervasive that it's so inconvenient not to do it, and it's by this time so commonplace that you do it, than by somebody saying you've got to do it this way or this is how the government will deliver its services. And I think there needs to be a lot more thinking about these social science aspects, which are ultimately going to be, in many cases, the rate-limiting and the acceptance-limiting factors. Then there's another set of things, just picking up on some of the things that Lord Sharman spoke about, the transformation that comes upon us and will yet further transform society through information technology of various kinds. And Moore's law that sees every 18 months or so a doubling of computational capacity, or alternatively half the price for the computational capacity you had, shows no sign of saturating. It's gone down through about 8 orders of magnitude, I think, maybe more, with no sign of saturating. And just as we begin to get to the point where people think it may saturate, that the physical limits of construction we see coming onto the scene, the beginnings of an ability to build molecular devices that will carry it right down. Again, what this will actually be like 20, 30 years from now, I think, is beyond imagining, as today would have been beyond imagining 25 years ago. But certainly some of the things it'll do, two of the things it's going to do, are quite amusing. It makes for a vastly smaller world. It already makes for a world where, in combination with tax laws, you can, with sufficient creativity, if you're, for example, my ex-countryman Murdoch, you can create a vast empire completely within a legal framework where you essentially don't pay tax anywhere. There's a very interesting transcendent moral question as to whether that strictly legal use, running ahead of the wit of others, is itself immoral to the point of some higher illegality or not. That's not something we have the framework to discuss, but it's just the tip of an iceberg. And it also shades us into a very tricky area, what we call crime. Because some of the potential here to commit what will legitimately and genuinely and recognisably be crimes are going to be crimes against corporations rather than individuals. And society has always had a different view of crimes against corporations and collectives than it did crimes against individuals. It may never have spelled it out, but we have it right today. We even have different kind of prisons to put Maxwell in from your common minor criminal. And I think there are interesting questions that are going to be brought into sharper focus that way that we just don't easily think about. We've touched on the question of encryption. There are fascinating questions there that go right to the heart of science, indeed, and earlier in the States than we overtly dealt with them here. They're questions of to what extent do you infringe the liberty of researchers to pursue particular areas of mathematics. That's an active issue. And that's not one that conventionally came up, I suspect, in the panel, but that's a real civil libertarian question that's apt to be misperceived as just a technicality. There's no question, however, that ultimately electronic theft and fraud is going to occur more quickly, more pervasively. It's going to be harder to catch it in the act. Then the information about how to compromise a system will be available more quickly and more pervasively to more people. Then there's the other point that was touched on, shifting ground but still in the heading of information technologies, that again Lord Sharman touched on briefly, of the extent to which this may or may not create a society where there's much greater degree of isolation, where people can work from home and in so doing offer new opportunities for different kinds of fraud and criminality, and different kinds of social pathology. And that's all, I think, to be wrapped in this, although it tends to be seen as epiphenomenological, and I think some of it's central. Two other things, quickly. The new world, as I've already said, will be smaller. It won't be smaller because it'll shrink the physical appearance of the world, as it were. It'll be smaller because much of the things, just as if I'd been back in Harrison's time to have walked off with your watch, I'd have been staggering out under the weight of it. The thing that I did my thesis on was a mainframe computer full of stuff. Today, I could put it in a pocket. More and more, the things that we value, often with information that is crucial to being able not just to invade our privacy or actually to invade our possessions, which will be more and more virtual hold, miniaturized things that are more easily stolen, and we've only begun to see the first faint shadow of that as nanotechnology gathers pace. And at the same time, as I say, in some sense, the opportunities for doing things to avoid crime need to be taken on a larger scale. One of the things that didn't feature as prominently in the report as I think it might have is the opportunities of using new technologies and in the built environment, so that you build the environment, whether it's a housing estate or a new estate, in such a way as to be crime unfriendly versus crime friendly. In short, this is an extraordinarily pervasive question. It was quite correctly identified as cutting across all the panels of the foresight exercise. I think it stretches all the way. It engages the city. It engages the secret services and GCHQ. It engages the mathematics community right on beyond the frontiers of research. It engages the life sciences community and the capacity that comes from our understanding of the molecular machinery of life. It engages material science and miniaturization. I think it's one of probably the most fascinating of all the themes, if it weren't for the fact that I was getting older and I think aging is also interesting.